This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Preborn. We want to save 300 babies' lives by giving their moms free ultrasounds, and you can help. Your gift of $140 will give free ultrasounds to five young women. Please help by calling 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or go to preborn.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again this hour, brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can save the lives of five babies. Find out how at janetmeffer.com. Good news out of the state of Illinois. I was really excited to see this. I've been following this story for quite a while. I'm sure you know about it as well. And if not, we're going to tell you about it. It involves a 2016 amendment that was attached to the existing Illinois Healthcare Right of Conscience Act. And it was absolutely horrible. It would basically end up requiring pro-life medical professionals and pro-life pregnancy centers to give abortion information to patients, which is absolutely crazy. And now a federal court has agreed that it is crazy. I don't know if they actually use that word in the court, but a federal judge in Illinois, according to the Christian Post, has now handed down this major victory for religious conscience and free speech protection this week, granting a statewide preliminary injunction against this 2016 amendment, the law change that would have forced pro-life medical providers to refer patients to abortion businesses upon request. Can you imagine anybody thinking this way? Hey, you're a pro-lifer. We're going to make you promote abortion to your patients. Though the law had not yet been enforced despite a January 2017 effective date, the state's 147 pro-life pregnancy centers, at least 74 of which offer free ultrasounds, have been vulnerable to the state's demands for nearly 7 months. Gutting provisions previously enshrined in Illinois' Healthcare Right of Conscience Act, once considered the gold standard, by the way, of freedom protections across the country, this change would have forced pro-life medical professionals of all kinds to cultivate a list of known abortion mills in their area to hand to patients. This was, by the way, signed into law by the Republican governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner. I can tell you this from personal experience. The Republicans in Illinois are not conservatives, not by the longest of shots. The change also threatened to force pro-life medical professionals and pregnancy centers to counsel patients as to the so-called benefits of abortion. Benefits of abortion. The judge said it is clear that the amended act targets the free speech rights of people who have a specific viewpoint. The federal court preliminary injunction broadly protects all healthcare facilities, healthcare personnel, or physicians who object to providing information about healthcare providers who may offer abortion or who object to describing abortion as a beneficial treatment option. Of course, they all went nuts in the pro-life community. This is fantastic. This is the right ruling. This is the right way to go. I'm sure it's not over. They will fight. There will be more pushbacks and more appeals, and we'll see what happens. And Planned Parenthood will go nuts, and Cecile Richards will scream, and all the rest. They're so desperate because they know that they're losing at the cultural level. They know they're losing in the culture. And so they have to use the law to try to make people go along with the agenda. It's just absolutely desperate. And it's wonderful that we see in this particular case a judge getting it right. So continue to pray for that situation in the state of Illinois. It's good to beat these things back, not just because it's happening in that particular location, but also because it will send a message to any other states that happen to consider doing something equally stupid, that if you go forward and try to do this, you will likely get beaten back in court. So very, very good. Now, some interesting stories are happening out there. I came across this one, which I thought was just so insane, and it got me thinking on a broader level about what is happening in the culture. Here's the story from the Daily Caller. It involves two professors from Texas A&M University, of all places, out of the Women's Studies Division, Professors Tasha Dubrowny and Kristen Perot. And they are arguing that memorials and monuments signify white heterosexual male supremacy and perpetuate inherently conservative historical narratives. What in the world? They put this out in an article called Gender and Public Memory in the Southern Communication Journal. This is what they said. Public memory scholars consistently argue that U.S. commemorative practices and traditions promote historical narratives that are inherently conservative in nature. Wittingly or not, these places of public memory are likely to mask foundational commitments to white, heterosexual, male supremacy, class hierarchies, and the systemic violence used to secure them. Well, let me just stop these dear ladies right there. Considering that this country was founded by white, heterosexual males, how do we honor those who came before us without featuring white, heterosexual males? That doesn't matter. That does not matter. It's horrid. We must stand up against these sorts of monuments. It's probably why the Louisiana Democrats just chucked their Jefferson Jackson dinner, which has been around for years, and now they're calling it the True Blue Gala or some such nonsense because they don't want to honor Thomas Jefferson or Andrew Jackson because they held slaves. You can purge history as much as you want, but pretty soon what you're going to be presenting to people is not a true version of history. And it's interesting to me that at least from the wording in this particular article, when they talk about the historical narratives being inherently conservative, to me that just seems like some kind of code for saying that they're true. They're true. Is it conservative to be true? Truthful, factual, rational, presenting things as they actually were, that's conservative now. It should be, across the spectrum, something that we're all willing to do to tell the facts. Good, bad, indifferent, tell the facts. The facts are what they are. Now, this is why they like to toy with history and take certain things out and put certain things in and emphasize this person over that person and not talk about this person and focus on something that will not marginalize anybody. And this is a lot of what we're hearing in the culture today. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is there is a name for what is going on among the resistance right now. You know, the progressives are all coalescing under this heading of the resistance. And in many respects, it's weird because you have all sorts of different groups coming together that in many respects shouldn't be coming together at all because they're contradictory to one another. Muslim activists and feminists. Are you kidding me? Muslim activists and gay activists? Are you kidding me? But it doesn't matter because the whole goal of it all is to deconstruct the United States and the American system and the American Constitution as it stands because they see it as inherently offensive and it sets up borders and male privilege and white privilege and white supremacy and all the rest. And this is why we're hearing about it all the time. So there's this name, a term, and maybe you've heard it before, of intersectionality. This is something that was invented by a law professor by the name of Kimberly Crenshaw. She did an interview on this a few years ago. Here she is describing exactly what this term means. This is cut one.
Intersectionality is basically the idea that we experience life, sometimes discrimination, sometimes benefits, based on a number of different identities that we have. So the basic term came out of a case where I was looking at black women who were being discriminated against, not just as black people, not just as women, but as black women. So intersectionality was basically a metaphor to say, well, they've got race discrimination that they're facing coming from one direction. They've got gender discrimination coming from another direction, and they're colliding in their lives in ways that we don't really anticipate and understand. So intersectionality is basically meant to help people think about the fact that discrimination can happen on the basis of several different factors at the same time. And we need to have a language and ability to see it in order to address it.
Now, here's another definition from the Wikipedia, which says it's the study of intersections between different disenfranchised groups or groups of minorities, specifically the study of the interactions of multiple systems of oppression or discrimination. And the Spectator says this seems rather mature and dignified in how they're defining it. But in reality, it seeks to make a manifesto out of the nastiest bits of Mean Girls, wherein non-white feminists especially are encouraged to bypass the obvious task of tackling the patriarchy's power in favor of complaining about white women's perceived privilege in terms of their hair texture and body shape. Think of all those episodes of Jerry Springer where two women who look like Victoria's Secret models are fighting over a man who resembles an artichoke. I'm not saying it. This article is saying it. Sitting smugly in the middle. And you have the end result of intersectionality made all too foul flesh. It may have been intended as a way for disabled women of color to address such allegedly white ableist feminist specific issues as equal pay, but it's ended up as a screaming, squawking, grievance hawking shambles. There you go. We're going to get back to this. We're going to take a break, though, very quickly here on Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
In 2013, I made my first visit to Israel where I was forever changed. I dare say no one can walk into Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Museum, and not be marked forever. Even more than the Holocaust Museum in Washington, it is a reminder of our responsibility in world affairs. It's also a reminder for us as Christians. We must remember that the Old Testament serves as the Israelis' deed to their home, the Promised Land. This is not a popular opinion these days, but as believers, we must ask, do we really believe what we read in scriptures? I hope to shed some light on this topic for you as you read through Feisty and Feminine. Pick up a copy today.
Penny Nance's latest book, Feisty and Feminine, empowers Christian women to engage the culture. And it's our gift to thank you for your donation today. Request yours at CapitolHillBrief.org. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. Janet Mefford Today and Preborn are partnering to save 300 babies' lives this summer.
Well, my name is Dan Steiner, and I'm the president of Preborn. Ultrasound truly is a game changer. When a mom comes into a pregnancy center under pressure to abort her child, perhaps the dad's gone, perhaps her mother is pressuring her. Most of the time in her heart, she doesn't want to abort, but what she needs is something that will give her the strength to choose life against the pressures that are forcing her to consider abortion. That's the ultrasound. If she hears her baby's heartbeat and sees that baby on ultrasound, everything's different. 80% of the time, she'll choose life.
Will you join us in saving babies' lives? A $140 sponsorship gives five babies a chance at life, and you'll get a picture of the babies' lives that were saved. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now 855-601-BABY or 855-601-2229 or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. Thanks for joining us. We're talking a little bit about this term intersectionality. You might not be very familiar with what that is all about. I've been trying to explain a little bit about it because it does go a long way toward explaining what we're seeing in our culture. If you've been asking yourself, how is it that under the heading of the resistance, you have Muslim activists hanging out with gay activists and no one sees any sort of problem there? Or Muslim activists hanging out with feminists and nobody has a problem there. What is it that is uniting these people? And from some of the descriptions about it, it really comes down to an entire group of people who believe they are oppressed by the current system. And there are endless routes you can take to complain about your present status. And even writers from the left and writers from the right have commented on how intersectionality is to some extent insane. One of the examples of this, as commentary wrote about, was the fever sapping Trump's opposition under this heading of the resistance was evident in microcosm this week in the meltdown of the Women's March's social media presence on Twitter. And they said on there, if you'd seen it, it says, "Happy birthday to the revolutionary Asada Shakur." This is from the Women's March, dedicating the day's resistance related activities in her honor. Now, Shakur is perhaps better known as Joanne Chesimard, who is someone with a felony record, including the execution-style murder of a New Jersey state trooper. And she now resides in communist Cuba as a fugitive from American justice. The outrage that followed the Women's March's endorsement of a cop killer, exile, and unrepentant black nationalist was such that the organization was compelled to explain itself. Now listen to the excuse they made here. They said, this is not to say that Asada Shakur has never committed a crime, and not to endorse all of her actions. We say this to demonstrate the ongoing history of government and right-wing attempts to criminalize and discredit political activists. So it's our fault then. It's the government's fault. It's the right-wing's fault. And as they say in this article, this fanatical display of befuddlement perfectly encapsulates the logic of intersectionality. It demonstrates why this Vogue ideology shackles its devotees to doomed causes and sinking ships. They talk about intersectionality as a beast born in liberal hothouses on college campuses, slouching now toward the halls of power. It is a Marxist notion that all discrimination is linked because it is rooted in the unjust power structures that facilitate inequality. So there are no distinct struggles against prejudice. Class, race, gender, sexual identity, these and other signifiers are bound together by the fact that oppression is institutional and systemic. The problem with this ideology is it compels its adherents to abandon discretion. To sacrifice anyone with a claim to oppression is to forsake every victim of prejudice. So, sure, Asada Shakur robbed, assaulted, incited violence, and killed a cop, but she also hates capitalism and white supremacy, so she's one of us. And then you get into the whole thing about Linda Sarsour, one of the march organizers, she who called for jihad against the Trump administration. She's this self-styled organizer for civil rights and the Muslim community. She's been acclaimed by the ACLU. But look at what she is. Look at who she is. She's awful. She's reprehensible. And yet she is embraced by people who ought to be embracing the classical liberal ideas of free speech and all the freedoms we've enjoyed, individual liberty, etc. This is crazy. It can't last, really, because when you come together with all these people who say, I'm oppressed, no, I'm oppressed, no, I'm oppressed, well, let's hail you for this, but ignore this, which is oppressive to him, which is also oppressive to her. How do you even keep it up? Now, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to go back to this audio I was playing for you a little bit earlier from Kimberly Crenshaw. She is the law professor who coined the term intersectionality. And she was doing this interview with this student at Lafayette College a couple of years back. She was asked about her background. What was it about her background that sort of informed her and created her into becoming the woman she is? This is cut two.
My mother is what I guess in the last century we used to call race women. They're women who were deeply committed to the idea of racial justice, and they were committed to fighting for the rights of people of color, including and especially women. So she would talk about some of the ways that racism gets experienced by black people who are women, not just black people who are men, and basically give me tools to see when it was coming at me. So, you know, different ways that you might be spoken to as a black woman as opposed to being a white woman, having to keep your eye out for harassing behavior at work. Sexual harassment actually came from black women's employment experience. Mm-hmm. The first plaintiffs were black women because these are kind of things that would happen to black women in the workforce. So just the general way in which you're a woman but not quite the kind of woman that you're supposed to be. These are the kinds of things that my mom taught me about. So I had sort of a race lens from the family as a whole, and then my mother would talk more specifically about, now as a woman, these are the things that you're going to have to look out for.
The unfortunate part of all this is it ends up creating people as permanent victims. That's the unfortunate part. It really sends a message to people that you are always going to have to be on the lookout for someone oppressing you. At every moment, somebody might say something cross to you at work, and you're going to assume they said it to you because of your race or because of your sex or because of whatever oppressed class you happen to be in addition to those things. You will always look at people with suspicion. You will always look at people as oppressing you and being mean to you when, in fact, maybe they had a point for saying something cross to you that had something to do with you, that had nothing to do with your race or your sex or your class or whatever it is. Permanent victim status does not bode well for your life. All of us. And I am not saying that there are not times where people really are mistreated because of one of those categories. Certainly that's the case. But all of us have stories where somebody mistreated us or maybe sexually harassed us or even worse. But it's not always linked to your race. It's not always linked to your sex. Sometimes it is. But at any rate, deal with the problem. what it ends up doing is balkanizing the culture into the oppressors and the oppressees, and the oppressees get to decide who the oppressees are, even though sometimes the oppressors are also oppressees. Witness all of this struggle between Christians and the secular culture, where you have a florist who's told you cannot refuse two homosexuals as customers, and she says, I'll do anything else. I'll sell you flowers. I'll do whatever you want. I can't for two men to get married. That's wrong. I'm not participating in that. Well, who's being oppressed here? The two men or Baronelle Stutzman? She has a First Amendment right to live by her religious conscience. So this is the problem. This class gets to be victims. This class does not get to be victims. What, because she's white? I don't know if anybody who adheres to intersectionality has ever commented on Baronelle Stutzman. But you see my point. Now listen to this. This is an interesting little tidbit as well from Kimberly Crenshaw. One of the critiques, as this interviewer points out, of Black Lives Matter, which has Marxist ties itself, is that people will say every life matters. It isn't just Black Lives Matter. Black lives do matter. And so do all lives, because we're all human beings trying to bring everybody together. This is something that Kimberly Crenshaw reacts to. Cut three.
The Black Lives Matter popular version of colorblindness, right? We can't speak with any particularity about the risks that certain things will happen to people who are embodied in a particular way, because to do that is to exclude all the other people, right? So, you know, one of the most tremendously troubling things that happened after the Civil Rights Movement is the way that some of the victories of the Civil Rights Movement have been turned on their head. So, you know, Brown versus Board of Education now has been twisted into an idea that it is discriminatory to take into account race at all in school assignments, even if race is being taken into account to continue the process of desegregation, right? So the idea is everybody is similarly situated with respect to race. That's part of the idea behind all lives matter. Like, everybody is similarly situated with respect to the likelihood that they'll be driving down the street one day and a police officer will, you know, interrupt their day and they might end up in handcuffs or worse. It just is not the case that everyone is similarly situated with respect to this.
Except I don't think that's what people mean. When they say all lives matter, they're trying to make a point. We have had police officers killed, and then it became blue lives matter. Well, there were people who didn't want to talk about blue lives mattering. They only wanted to talk about black lives matter, because you have some really over-the-top, intense, progressive Marxist activists running this group. And there are well-meaning people, I'm sure, who jump on board thinking it's only about the cop killings. But the main point is that all lives do matter, that all lives matter. Anybody who is killed by a cop in an illegal way where there was no confrontation and no threat to the police officer, that life matters. What about the Australian woman in Minnesota who was killed by the black Muslim Somalian American refugee who killed her, and we still don't know a lot of details about that? Does her life matter? Of course her life matters. And this is what is so important for us to get our heads around. And as Christians, I think it's really incumbent upon us to stress. We cannot separate ourselves into victim classes. Yes, there is injustice. That's why we have the legal system. That's why we have our courts. That's why we have a wonderful constitution and a lot of really importantly good laws that we can all take advantage of, that we can all use for justice, regardless of what our color is or sex or race or ethnicity or what have you. It really is the case that America is a wonderful country because everybody is equal under the law, and we don't need to balkanize. We need to be more concerned about E Pluribus Unum. And by the way, when we're talking about lives, I want to remind you that we are working this summer to save 300 preborn lives with a great ministry called Preborn. $140 will save 5 lives. They help provide free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. And these women, 80% of them will choose life if they have the opportunity to get an ultrasound. It is a wonderful ministry. And we are about halfway there. We want to save 300 babies. We're about halfway there. We need your help. So if you could donate, the number is 855-601-BABY, 855-601-BABY, or 855-601-2229, or janetmefford.com. The banner is Your Love Saves a Life. You can donate there. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Preborn. We want to save 300 babies' lives by giving their moms free ultrasounds, and you can help. Your gift of $140 will give free ultrasounds to five young women. Please help by calling 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or go to preborn.com. To Janet Meffer Today. This is a really interesting story. The headline, Anti-Christian Bigotry is Surging in UK and US. This is via CNS News, and this is from Bill Donahue over at the Catholic League. There is a study that's been done by Premier Christian Communications in the UK, and they interviewed 12,000 Christians over there, assessing prejudice and discrimination against them. And the findings include these numbers. 93% of these Christians said that Christianity is being marginalized in society. 80% say Christianity is not given equal respect. And 67% say they are unable to be open about their faith at work. And he goes on to say that this is increasingly the case here in the United States. Well, our friends at Concerned Women for America are on the front lines fighting for our religious liberty, and we're just delighted to welcome back to the program Penny Nance, who is CEO and President. Penny, great to welcome you back.
Oh, thanks, Janet. Great to be back with you.
Well, thank you. I don't think this will be news to you, since this is part and parcel of what you're doing every single day, but what do you make of these numbers that increasingly, not just in the UK, but here at home, we are seeing the marginalization of Christians? I know the secularists tend to say, Christians are in the majority. What are you talking about? How would you interpret what's going on? Would you agree?
Well, I would say that that those numbers are not just indicative of the UK, but I think I hear all the time that same story here in the U.S. And I hear about, you know, in the workplace, people fearing. I have conversations with teachers all the time in which kids are struggling against drugs, just demonic games, suicidal games, all kinds of horrific things that would curl your hair, and yet these teachers don't feel free to share their faith or to point them towards God. I mean, it really has become very difficult for believers to, and you know, so that's just one piece of it. We're seeing this really come to fruition, even as we talk about Christians being appointed to important government jobs in the federal government and people doing business with the federal government. Janet, you probably remember when the Russell Voigt hearing and with a deputy director of OMB,
yes,
in which Bernie Sanders suggested, because he basically had written in something called The Resurgent about the fact that Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man come to the Father by me, and was very clear on a Christian principle. And that, and Bernie Sanders said that it disqualified him for public service. And we're going to see more of it.
We are. When I think also of Mark Green, I believe was his name, who was the potential Army Secretary, and he had been attacked by progressives and by gay activists and so forth. He's not qualified to be in that position, and he ended up withdrawing his name from the nomination.
Yes.
This is really something that the left is liking, I think, Penny. And for many Christians, the question is, why are they marginalizing us?
Well, I don't know, but it's certainly, well, I do know. It is spiritual, Janet.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. This is spiritual warfare, clear and simple, but it's unconstitutional.
It is.
Article 6, paragraph 3 specifically says there can be no religious test for whether serving in public office through votes or an appointment. But we have really got to go in, and I think our friends at ADF are already a part of this, and, you know, do the legal work, do the lawsuits needed to protect the rights of Christians to live out their faith and have a job, whether it's in the free, you know, the private sector, and certainly within government or as a governmental employee or someone who's doing contractual work with the government. Our rights are not being protected.
Right. You make such a really, really good point there, Penny, which is, even if it is spiritually induced, which we all know it is because we know the Bible, it is not constitutional. And I see this trend, maybe you see it too better than I do, this trend of really moving more in the direction that you see in some of these Muslim majority countries and talking about freedom of worship. We have no problem, you know, the Bernie Sanders, we have no problem if you want to practice your religion, but just keep it all out of public life. Isn't this completely opposite of what our founders had in mind when they acknowledged that we have this fundamental, inalienable right to religious freedom?
Right, and went to the trouble to enshrine it in the First Amendment.
Right.
Because they specifically wanted to protect the right of people to practice their faith wherever. You don't leave your faith at the schoolhouse door. You don't leave it when you walk into your business. That was part of the whole argument in the Hobby Lobby case.
Right.
Whether you're at home or whether you're at work, your faith defines you, or it should. And by the way, people should be glad of that. They should be glad that our men and women in the military are people who believe in truth and honor and dignity of life. And therefore, the people that are holding our guns also recognize the sanctity of human life. Those are important principles, and we should be grateful for that instead of trying to quash it. And you know, really, the hot button issue is our views on sexuality, our views on, you know, living a life unto the Lord, at the sanctity of marriage. That's, you know, the other issue that really bothers people. But,
yes,
you know, it is based on biblical principles. We can't, a woman said to me one time, because on the issue of Jesus is the way to heaven, she said, I don't feel accepted by you. And I said, well, I don't feel accepted by you. I said, this is my faith.
Right.
I love you, and I, you know, and the right to proselytize is part of our religious freedom, and we must protect that right. But you have the right to proselytize me, by the way.
Yeah.
If you love me, you will.
Right.
If you love me, you will share your faith. And my husband, I'll never forget, had a mechanic who was Muslim, and he kept trying to give him a Quran. And we weren't angry about that at all. In fact, I felt like that was a very loving effort on his part. Of course, my husband's a Christian, and he's like, well, let me show you what I think. Christians are being marginalized, and it seems like every other kind of minority religion or faith, everyone has an equal right to, you know, share their rainbow flags or wear their rainbow shirts to work, but don't dare wear a cross. And we've got to stop that.
Yes, and we have actually seen cases like that in the UK where people tried to wear crosses at work and it turned into a big legal battle. Well, and Penny, the other thing that springs to mind, because this has been in the news in the last week or so, is the fact that you have groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center painting mm-hmm. groups like Concerned Women for America as hate mm-hmm. groups. I've had about enough of them. I'm sure you do too, but
yeah.
Explain to people what that does when you see yourself mm-hmm. on a list of a hate group, you know, a list of hate mm-hmm. groups when you are the opposite of a hate group.
Well, in FRC has been, I think, Family Research Council and ADF have been the hardest hit on this. I think we're like tier two or something because of our position specifically on traditional marriage. That's it. That's
right.
All they've got.
Right.
And so in order to snuff out debate, they have stooped to labeling you as a hate group because you don't agree with them. Because in as loving way as you possibly can, you can say, this is what the Bible says, this is what I believe. Of course, you have a right to live your life as you choose, but you can't force me to be a part of it, you know? And
right.
And that alone, that's enough to make you hateful and bigoted and so on. And so that's the strategy. The strategy is to marginalize. And they even went as far, in cases of some groups, charity navigators use them as a guide, and for a while had at the top, when you pulled up their names, the fact that they were a hate group in
yes.
order to keep people from giving to them.
Yes.
And charity navigators got some pushback, as they should have, because unfortunately, Southern Poverty Law Center started out as a group that, you know, and this happens, there's a mission group. They started out a long time ago as a group, a civil rights group, and fought against racism and, you know, awful, awful things. And then, you know, they had a mission creep, and now they have offshore accounts that are coming from nefarious places. People think perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood and others, I'm not sure, but it seems as though there's some scary money coming their way, and they're completely, you know, have embraced and are taking the hardest line possible on the issue of gay rights and this labeling and anti-Christian bigotry. And so I'm looking forward to someone labeling them as anti-Christian bigots is what they are.
Yeah, they really are. They really are. When you look at that hate map that they put out, that was what was the inspiration for the shooting at the Family Research Council. That was the inspiration, apparently, or at least it was liked by that shooter of Representative Steve Scalise just weeks ago during that congressional baseball practice. So SPLC is not doing Christians any favors. But we're going to come back. Penny Nance with us from Concerned Women for America here on Janet Meffer Today.
Want to experience a closer relationship with God today? Well, the good news is God desires intimacy with you more than you could ever imagine. This is Jeannie Nigro with Unshaken. If you want to grow closer to God, you simply need to think what He thinks and feel what He feels about everything. And that includes His future millennial reign. God has very specific, tangible plans for the future. You will not just be floating around on clouds forever. You'll be ruling and reigning with Jesus over nations. How exciting is that? When you share His passion, focusing your hope not on this world, but on the one that is to come, and study Isaiah, Zechariah, Daniel, and Ezekiel, you experience greater intimacy with God. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's JeanneNigro.com/Janet.
Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save 300 babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Last week, just one example of a mom who came in was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her, and she said, "I just can't allow this baby to be killed," were her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229. Or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Penny Nance, CEO and President of Concerned Women for America. Check them out at CapitolHillBrief.org. You hear the great Capitol Hill Brief feature, and it's just a wonderful thing to have her here again. One of the things we've been talking about as we've been discussing the attacks on religious liberty, Penny, I came across this story over at the Daily Beast, one of the most reliably leftist sites at times. Mm-hmm. And they have this story here about the ACLU now plans to sue the Trump administration because they want to see what the Trump administration has in mind with its religious liberty plan. You know, the president, as you know, you were there, signed this religious liberty executive order. I believe it was back in May. And they think, oh, he's going to stem the progress that has been made by the LGBTQ community, and he's going to overturn women's rights and overturn Roe v. Wade. What is this nefarious Trump administration up to? What is behind this idea that we're going to sue the administration in its quest to protect religious liberty? What do you make of this? Explain to people what you think this is all about.
Well, it's just one more strategy to keep in place policies that are anti-Christian. Under the Obama administration, the federal government was discriminating against contractors that were people of faith, against employees. And it's been a real problem. And fortunately, the Obama administration is doing their best to try to clean up the mess. In addition to that, and I think what they're really trying to get to is the fact that we have coming down the pike some fantastic executive orders clarification of regulations coming out of HHS that will finally really protect the little sisters of the poor.
Good.
And others who don't want to their money to be entwined and to be dirtied by the abortion industry. Of course, that's an anathema to them, and they want to stop it any way possible. So, of course, you know, they can't win in Congress, so they're going to try to use the courts.
Right. What do you think is coming? I know specifically we're not necessarily privy to what is going on behind closed doors, but what would you like to see the Trump administration do in HHS with some of these other issues pertaining to abortion, freedom of conscience, freedom of religious liberty as we've known it as Americans? What would you prefer to see this administration do? What would you like to see them do next?
Well, I think they have to go, and they've done a lot already. They've gone back and changed a lot of the directives, but I think they have to be very clear and very forthcoming that you cannot discriminate against a contractor, an employee, based on religion. And that is what the Constitution says in Article 6, Paragraph 3. And so they need to be more definitive on that, and they also need to, if you remember, the Little Sisters of the Poor case was based on regulations coming from HHS by Kathleen Sebelius. So those need to be reversed because they lost in court, and it sent the issue back to the government and said, you need to clean up what you're doing, but the Obama administration never did it.
Right.
So that's what they're working on behind closed doors right now to do, to finish up and to basically do what the court told them to do, what the Supreme Court said for them to do, and unanimously, by the way.
That's right.
And so, you know, I expect that it will come out. I know about it. I've talked to other people about it, and I think they're just kind of putting the final touches on it, but this is making them crazy. And so, you know, the whole idea of resistance has many facets. It's, you know, the unwashed masses with dirty signs dressed up as women's genitalia in the streets, and it's people in the court, you know, filing cases in the court, and working, you know, to agitate against Congress.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's really crazy. There doesn't seem to be as much of a consensus as there used to be on these principles that really have been part and parcel of what it means to be American. I mean, if you take away religious freedom, how do you maintain the America that we always have known, Penny?
That's right. Well, and I think people are wise to this. You know, we were talking earlier about the polling data, and that's true here in the U.S. People feel bullied and they feel marginalized. And I honestly think that was part of why 81% of evangelicals and a majority, I think 53% of Catholics, voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They're tired of it. And they may not be willing to fight with their coworkers. They may not be willing to speak up in a room full of people, but they can quietly go into the voting booth and wield their power.
Yes.
And that's what happened. And it's going to happen again. And I'll tell you another thing. If that election happened again today, even with all of this, all the noise about Russia, everything that's going on, I guarantee you if Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump went to the polls again today, Donald Trump would still win.
Yes, I think so, too. I think so, too. Hillary, by the way, is out there putting out T-shirts on Twitter about a woman of power or something like that. Hillary, time to retire. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
She needs to hike some more.
I do think that. Go back to the woods and run into some closely held publicist that you used to work with.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Indeed. Now, we've got this case coming up. This is going to be a very important one, Penny. And this is one of the most important religious freedom cases that has come up in quite a while. We've seen so many of these Christian bakers and florists and wedding industry vendors who have been under fire legally simply for saying, I don't want to materially participate in your so-called same-sex wedding. Jack Phillips, he's the Colorado baker. The Supreme Court said it's going to be reviewing his case. How important do you see this case in terms of solving all of this madness against the wedding industry and the Christians who have been under attack?
I think it's very important, and it will be precedent setting. You're talking about masterpiece bakers.
Yeah.
You know, this is such a beautiful story because this family has a company, a bakery, and they use it to serve the Lord. They see that as a ministry, and they believe that their work is art, and they do it as unto the Lord. And it is art. It's beautiful. You'll see, if you look at his website, you'll see him painting on the top of a cake, you know, using brushes, and it's gorgeous.
Yes.
And he, you know, uses his business for AA meetings. They take in homeless people. They've done all kinds of work within the community. And by the way, he refuses to do cakes for bachelor parties, things that, you know, that he thinks are inappropriate. It's not just this one issue. He's very clear on his faith, and he's living out his faith as best he can, day to day, walking out in his life. And yet, you know, when it came to a specific cake. He didn't want to do it. He suggested that another bakery in town would be happy to fulfill that order. And afterwards, you know, on another occasion, not a wedding, he'd be willing, more than willing to serve this customer. He serves homosexuals all the time, all day long, happy to do it. That's how you have a business. You bring in more customers, not less. But yet, you know, the gay, not gay people, gay activists,
right,
can't allow people the right to live their lives. And
right,
they only feel they win if they bully you into not just, you know, a live and let live ideology, but embracing their beliefs.
Yes.
And so, you know, we're going to court, and I believe he'll win. I mean, I believe he will.
I hope and pray he will as well. This is why, folks, it's so important to understand the great work that Concerned Women for America is doing, not only on Capitol Hill where Penny is, but also around the nation. Just give us a quick snapshot, if you would, Penny, about the kind of work that you guys are doing for us.
You know, Concerned Women for America is the voice of conservative women around this country. We're active in media, as I'm here today, but also on national media, television, radio, kind of giving the conservative Christian woman's perspective on key issues of the day. We have national lobbyists and grassroots activity at the federal level, and then we have 36 state directors, 400 adult chapters that are active in their states and their state legislatures and school boards around the country. We also have 38 college chapters. And the issue we've been talking today about, religious freedom, is one of our key issues. By the way, we're active in these court cases. We file amicus briefs. So we do PR. You know, it's not odd to see me in front of the Supreme Court on a key decision, doing media talking about the case,
right,
with a rally. We just won 7-2 on the Trinity Lutheran case, which had to do with a religious school's right to just, you know, compete for playground surfacing. And that was a religious freedom case, and we won. And so that we are very active on these issues, but we welcome more to the table. If your heart's stirred for the direction of your country, you want to have a voice, come join what we're doing.
Absolutely love it. And you can check out CapitolHillBrief.org. That's Capitol with an O, HillBrief.org, and find out more about the great work and mission of Concerned Women for America. I just love them. I love what they're doing. And I always love talking to you, Penny Nance. Thank you, Penny.
Thank you, Janet. God bless.
God bless you, too. And thanks again for being with us and for what you guys do every single day. We really, really appreciate you. Thank you for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time. God bless and take care.